it's been sponsored by myself in memory of my mother-in-law who passed away recently. The end of the solution is coming up this week. Her name was Feige Bas Yehuda Yitzchok. We also remember Ashley Klinger this time, and also it's the 100th anniversary of the termination of the First World War, so we could remember that too.
Thank you, Michael. You've taken away my whole introduction because I was going to mention all three issues. We have very fond memories, particularly myself and our family, of Mrs. Feige Storfer, who was not only a close neighbour of ours, but also a close friend of ours, a very sweet, kind, modest lady who sadly left us in this last month. And she should be a Melitza Siosha for all her family, and all the family Storfer are in our hearts, to which we share this tragedy with. We also remember our dear friend Ashley Klinger, who was a regular at this bagel share, and there was one quality about Ashley which I recall particularly in today's bagel breakfast share, which I'll be talking about later, and that was his deep respect for Rabbonim. And when we discuss our Abikoros share, we're going to be talking about the opposite kind of person who has the disrespect for Rabbonim. I was also going to mention the fact that today is Armistice Day, the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, 1918, and the fact that we've just been having the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht. You might say to me, well, what's the connection of that with our theme for how to answer Abikoros? Well, I'll try in the course of the next few minutes to answer that question as well. But coming to our topic, how to answer Abikoros, we did give an introduction last month. Doesn't matter if you missed it, because it was only an introduction, but we had the general theme of saying, well, if you do meet up with a kofer, an apikoros, a min, somebody who is a denier, then the best thing to do is not to mix with him at all. And therefore, in one word, I said, to summarize that shir, how to answer an apikoros, we said, don't. In fact, Rabbi Kohn came up to me since then and said to me, I think you can summarize your shir in two words of how to answer an abikoros.
With a principle.
Almost principle. And his two words are, get lost. Well, in an attempt to recognize that there's a slight chance that we might be makariv certain people who have gone off the derech, I thought we might deal with them in a more, intellectual approach. Let's have a look again at the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Daf Tzadi and Masechet Sanhedrin, it says, Kol Yisrael Yoshlem Chelek L'Alamabo. All Jews have a Chelek, have a portion in the world to come. Oh, what about a Rosha? So Chavetz Chaim talks about everyone's got a potential portion in the world to come. But people, in addition to doing their Averis, they are Zocher to Mitzvah, so every Jew has a portion in the world to come. However, continues the Mishnah, the Elu She'ein Rem Chelek Lambo, but there are three singled out who do not have a portion in the world to come. Ha'omer Ein Tchiyas HaMesim in HaTorah, a person who does not believe in Tchiyas HaMesim, of resurrection of the dead. And it says Min HaTorah, yeah. That it is a biblical thing. The Ein Torah Min HaShemayim, and the second person is someone who denies that the Torah is from heaven. We discussed last month that this is really someone who's called a Min and not necessarily an Abikoros, but we are speaking in generic terms today. And then the third category of the Mishnah is the Abikoros. The Mishnah there does not define Abikoros. And Rashi says, if you want to know what Abikoros means, have a look later on in the Gemara. So if you look later on in the Gemara, Daf Tzadi Tes Omud Beis, Abikoros, it doesn't give you the definition that you're expecting. It's not talking about someone who denies Torah Menav Shemayim. Rabbi Chanina Omri Zeh Hamavaze Talmud Chochom. Somebody who insults a Talmud Chochom. So there you have it. A person who insults a Talmud Chochom is not Zoche to Olam Haba. This is a halacha brought down by the Rambam in Perek Vav, Hilchos Talmud Torah, halacha Yud Aleph. and it is also a halacha brought down by the Shulchan Aruch in Yeradeosim and Reishmen Gimel Sifvov Ovan Godol Hu Levazos Talmid Chacham. It is a great sin to insult a Talmid Chacham, or lisnoson, or to hate him. B'chol ha'mavazes ha'chachomim ein achelek la'olam avo. So if you think that something said in the Mishnah is something which is just academic, it is brought down to the Shulchan Aruch, which is for our everyday halacha. And the Shulchan Aruch goes further, not simply to say that you're not allowed to, but somebody who does this transgression has no portion in the world to come. Now you can say, well, that's a bit stark, that's a bit strong, isn't it? But the person who is a Talmid Chacham is the one who personifies the Torah. He represents the Torah. He is not only there to represent it, but he's also teaching the Torah. And that person has that special duty and gift to represent the Torah in a personified form to teach us. So somebody who is insulting him, it is as if one is insulting the Torah. Now there are some people who go around and shackle very hard in their davening, and they've got wear a big black hat, and they might have long payos, and they've got tzitzis flying down to their knees, and everyone thinks what wonderful holy people they are. But if they are insulting a Talmid Chacham, then they are in that category, and they're not zocher to Olam Haba. And it's pretty serious. I once went into a shul where there was a guy davening at the Amud, and he was well known for his, how shall I say, his pronouncements of scoffing at Rabbonim. So I asked the gabbar, why do you ask this fellow to daven? He said, oh, he's got a good voice. It's a problem, and there are people who want to dictate to their rabbonim how they should be leading their community. Of course, we all know the one about the gabbai who says to the rav, you know, you're offending a lot of people when you're telling them not to bring their car on Shabbos. You can't talk about Shabbos. He said, well, what do you want me to talk about? Shall I talk about kashrus? No, don't talk about kashrus. You might offend people about the way they handle their dietary lifestyle. So the rabbi says, well, what should I talk about? So he said, talk about Judaism. Yesterday we read the parsha about Esav HaRosha. Esav HaRosha, he asked his father Shilas. He made out to his father, he was a real frummer. Said the Kotzke Rebbe, Esav wore a shtraimel, obviously in figurative terms. Shtraimel only came about with Russia and Poland. But the idea that the Kotzke Rebbe was trying to portray was the fact that sometimes you get this Russia who dresses up and pretends to play the role, to play the part. And it's a problem. Now, what is it about the Talmid Chacham, apart from the fact that he's teaching Torah, is that the Talmid Chacham possesses a special quality given to him called Siyata Dishmaya. He gets a special help from above. And that special zechus gives him the ability to pasken his shailas.
What about the Talmid Chacham, whose views may not be 100% in accordance with what we would accept?
The
Talmid Chacham.
There is a Chacham and there is a Talmid Chacham. The Chacham is a wise, clever guy. The Talmid Chacham is the one who realizes that he's always learning his whole life and he has to have humility. The Malbim writes in Tehillim, Perek Yud Tes, on Hashemayim, the Saprim Kavod Kel, he writes, it was a different Tehillim. The Malbim writes, I think it's Kafvov. The Malbim writes that a person...
Sorry.
Alright, somebody's trying to tell me a message. It's time to finish. So the Malbim writes that the person who is taking his learning Torah sincerely, he is rewarded with Siyata Dishmaya almost as though he has Nevuah, prophecy. But if it's somebody who is not possessing the basic ingredients of Yiras Shemayim, then that Siyata Dishmaya doesn't come. So yeah, you might get the scoffer saying, oh, well, this rabbi I'm criticizing doesn't have the Yiras Shemayim or something like that. But let's be honest about it. Now, what is this idea of Siyata Dishmaya that the Talmid Chacham gets? Rabbi Cohen, in fact, once said to me, he said, the zechus I have of Siyata Deshmaya is because of my tzibur. Because when you have a good tzibur, then the Rav gets a good Siyata Deshmaya. So he says, I've got a very good tzibur. That's the North Hendon community. Right. So the Gemara Ksuvos. The Gemara Ksuvos staff, Daf Samach on the base, talks about Abayo, who paskens that a woman who was a meinekes, who gave birth and was also a widow, she should leave in a period of time before she gets remarried of 15 months. But Abayo was outvoted, and the rule which was ordained was 24 months. And Abayo admitted that he had made a mistake in paskening in front of his Rebbe. One should never paskin in front of one's teacher. But that wasn't the real reason why he gave the wrong pasuk. He says, the real reason why I gave the wrong pasuk was that because I was paskening in front of my Rebbe, I did not get the Siyata Deshmaya. I was not getting this special divine gift. And therefore, I gave the wrong decision. And the story is told about the Noda Behuda, who was Rav Yecheskel Landau from Prague, and I believe all Landaus are descended from him, so we have one here in our presence. Thank you for being here, Jonathan. And the amazing thing about Prague was they had a lot of competition as to who should become the rabbi there, and some people wanted somebody else. You know what it's like, we want a different guy. And so when Rav Yecheskel Landau came to Prague, there were a group of people who thought they'll try and catch him out, and that way they might be able to discredit him from becoming the rabbi of the town. So this group sat down with him and they asked him a shaila. Apparently it was a shaila about a chicken and whether it was treif or not, but it was supposed to be a trick question. I heard another view that it was a shaila about brochas in the way that they are said and in the order they are said upon different foods. But whatever it was, when Rav Landau was asked this question, he remained silent. He wouldn't answer the question. Oh, you might think, well, this can't be a very good candidate. He's not answering the question. Surely he knows the answer. And it was perhaps a question which was rather easy one to answer. But he wouldn't answer it. So afterwards he was asked, why didn't you answer the question? He said, I felt I wasn't connecting. He said, when I get a shaila and I have to give the answer, I feel like I'm connecting and I'm getting this Siyata Deshmaya, this special divine assistance. And I wasn't getting it. It wasn't tuning in. So I wouldn't answer. Which is amazing, because how you say, how did he know? How did he know? But the story is told about Rav Knoblovitz, who was the Rav of the Hendon Hadass before Rabbi Roberts. He was the Rav in the 1950s, 60s in the Hendon Hadass, and some of us might remember him very well. And once somebody came up to him just after he retired, and he was regularly davening in the shul, and he was asked this shaila, and he answered, he said, listen, the question that you're asking is a very easy question to answer. In fact, without sounding arrogant, I could answer this in my sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I'm not going to answer your question, because I'm no longer the rabbi of this community. As long as I was the rabbi of the Kehillah, I received a Siyata Deshmaya, a special divine assistance. But because I'm no longer the rabbi, and you have another rabbi, I'm not going to answer the question. Apparently a similar dialogue took place after Rabbi Roberts retired of the Hendon Hadass. That the Rav has that special distinction and he's got a qualification, but he is reliant on a Siyata Deshmaya which is given to him. And this is the reflection given by the Malbim in Tehillim. He says, a person who learns sincerely and has this power, like a kind of Ruach HaKodesh, that he's got a shtickel nevuah in being able to answer questions because of his Siyata Deshmaya which he receives. And who was perhaps the greatest person in the last 100 years who had a special Siyata Deshmaya? Well, there may be many examples, but one example who I'm really thinking of is the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim died in 1933, and after the peace treaty, or the armistice, of November 11th, 1918, exactly 100 years ago today, he was saying to his Talmidim, shaking his head sadly, saying, this is not really over. Everyone thought when the First World War was over, now we're going to have democracy, now we're going to have liberation, we have done away with the Kaiser and the Tsar and the Ottoman Empire and so on and so forth. The Chofetz Chaim shook his head. He said, the preface to the next war, which will be more dreadful than anything we have seen till now. And that was how he labelled the armistice of the First World War. In 1930, a short time later, he said, a dreadful Holocaust is approaching. The world war we had a short while ago will be considered a plaything compared to what will be happening 10 years from now. And as we know, 1938 was Kristallnacht, also something which we're now commemorating. In the year 1931, he said he was chatting with Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And the Chofetz Chaim said after that, there is now a mortal danger to our lives, not only us, namely perhaps soldiers, but our wives and our children, who are in very mortal danger. And it's recorded that the Chofetz Chaim was found bitterly weeping as 1933 approached. And then he was asked by Rosh Yeshiva in 1933, well, what do you think? The Nazi party had started already. He said in tears that there will be Jews who will be destroyed. And he was asked, do you really mean what you're saying? He said, yes. He said to the Chofetz Chaim, so what will happen? What will happen to the Jewish people? Are the whole Jewish people going to be destroyed? So the Chofetz Chaim answered from next week's Parsha Vayishlach, chapter 32, verse 9, if Esav comes to one camp and strikes it down, then the camp which is left will escape. And he was asked, where will this camp escape to? And he quoted the Pasuk of Avadia, chapter 1, verse 17, Har Tzion. On Har Tzion there shall be those that escape, and it shall be holy. And the Chofetz Chaim died on the 24th of April, 1933. So he was saved from the Tsar of seeing what would happen after that. So all this is to do with this Siyata Dishmaya. You know, he was a great man, you could say. He wrote the Mishnah Berurah, he wrote Shmiras HaLoshon and others for him, and he was a very knowledgeable man and a great... But he had a special power, given his limud of Torah, that he had the Siyata Dishmaya as well. That he could even foretell the future. An amazing idea, which we can reflect upon just today, Armistice Day. And there was, in fact, a discussion going on between the Lubavitcher Rebbe and the previous Sadigera Rebbe about the subject of the three oaths, which we once discussed some time ago, and the whole debate about Eretz Yisrael and the way the Sutners are involved or not involved in it, and they talk about this idea. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe said to the Sadigera Rebbe, he said, when people come to me about the three oaths, I just shrug and I say, there's no Shiloh nowadays. It's not a question anymore. Why? Because the Jewish people are already there. They're already in Eretz Yisrael. You can't expect them to jump into the sea. So if there's no Shiloh, then when you are asked such a Shiloh to paskel in it, there's no Siyata Dishmaya. You can't possess any Siyata Dishmaya in answering a Shiloh when the Shiloh is a klotz kasha. It doesn't exist. Same idea. So you might say to me, what about the fact that we got machlokas between Rabbonim? He says it this way, he says it that way. Can they both have Siyata Dishmaya? So we say, Eilu v'Eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim. They are both the words of the living God, if their answer is the Shem Shamayim. They are both getting Siyata Dishmaya because they both may find a reason and a justification and a rationale for what they're saying. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that we are in a stage of Yiridas Hadoros where we have less qualities now than they used to be, so there is a difference of opinion. And there is in fact a Siman in Choshen Mishpot, Siman Chafhei, which discusses what happens when a Dayan makes a mistake. It might happen. And we had once a bagel breakfast show about the subject of infallibility. But that doesn't remove the fact that the people who are a Talmudic Chachamim deserve respect within the constraints that they might have around them, and that they do receive some form of Siyata Dishmaya. And it's not for us to mix in. I might have once said a story about Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz, but I'll say it again, which is a lovely story, and it was about Chag Gadyo, which we read on Pesach at the end of the Haggadah. Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz was once travelling, and he stopped off at an inn for a drink, and as he was sitting down, he saw some other Jews who were sitting there, and they were having a debate amongst themselves about the machlokas which was going on between Rav Yonatan Eibschitz and Rav Yaakov Emden. It was a well-known argument. There were accusations. One was siding with the Shabtai Tzvi and so on, but we won't go into that now. But they were debating who was right, and they couldn't make up their minds. So they saw Rav Yonatan Eibschitz there, he, the one whom they were talking about, but they didn't realize it was him. So they say, look, this looks like a very frum-looking Yid and respectable Jew. Let's see what he thinks. So they went up to him and said, you know about this machlokas between Rav Yonatan Eibschitz and Rav Yaakov Emden? Who's right? Now, you would expect Rav Yonatan Eibschitz to say, well, of course, Rav Yonatan Eibschitz is right. But he didn't say that. He said, now you've given me an understanding about something which I always had a problem with in Chag Gadyo. Because in Chag Gadyo, we got this poor little goat, which was bought for two zuz, and so the cat came and ate the goat, and then the dog came and struck the cat, and then there was the stick, and you know, all ending up through the various things, the water, the drinking of the water, the malachamoves, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. So the logical inference from the story is that the lamb was the good party and the cat was the bad party, and therefore the dog was the good one, and the one before that was the bad one. And he says, but the problem I've always had is when you have this pattern, you end up with HaKadosh Baruch Hu being chas v'shalom, the bad party. Mm-hmm. And that can't be. So what is the thrust of the story? How is it that we've got somewhere along the story, you must have either two good ones next to each other or two bad ones next to each other? He said, and now I realize what the answer is. Because after the cat was obviously bad, which ate the goat, you get the dog. He said, now I realize what happened. The dogs should not mix in. The dog was really a bad party. It's not for the dogs, namely the people who are the men on the street, to interfere with what is machlokas, the Shem Shemayim, between two great rabbonim. Right. So, you could say, what about free speech? The person who is on social media and is criticizing Rabbonim from his armchair, perhaps anonymously, because he knows that way he might get away with it, is somebody who you might say, well, he's entitled to express his opinion, but a person can be respectful, and if a person doesn't agree or understand what a Rav is saying, then you can go up to that Rav himself and say, look, I don't understand what you're saying because of reason 1, 2, and 3. And in a humble, respectful way, he can ask the Rav why he says what he says. But if he stands up and says scoffing remarks, mocking remarks about a Talmid Chacham, he is deemed to be called an Abikoros. A lesson for, well, Baruch Hashem, we don't have anyone in here who comes into that category, I'm sure. But unfortunately, there are some very well-dressed, respectable-looking people in the community who unfortunately come within that category. So we asked Dan Malahoshev, Malahoshev, what do you answer to an Abikoros? Should you really be debating with such a person who is mocking a Talmid Chacham? And there again, the best thing is perhaps to ignore him and to keep away from him. But what we said last month was that when we have to know how to answer an Abikoros, it may often be simply how to comfort ourselves and to know ourselves what the correct answers are and how we deal with this. That is the end of one of our sections of what is an Abikoros, somebody who's mavazeh Talmid Chacham. But the classic definition, Abikoros or denier, is somebody who's not saying Torah is Minas Shemayim, somebody who believes that the world got here by accident, that over a period of millions or billions of years things happened, and does not recognize the gadlus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that brings me then to the next part of our theme, and that is these people who are the deniers, who are saying, well, the world is around here by accident. We said yesterday in the Tehillim HaShemayim HaSaprim Kavod Kel, Tehillim Yud Tes, that the wonders of nature you can see just by looking at the heavens and looking at the constellations and the stars, how they work with a pattern, that nothing happens by accident. The different planets have an effect on the gravity of other planets, so that's why we have gravity in this planet. So the amazing things when you study nature, and Avraham Avinu recognized at the age of 3 years old that there must be a supernatural power called God, because he saw how the beautiful pattern of nature existed. And the Lev Elio asks, why does the Tehillim, why does David HaMelech talk about the heavens? Why can't he talk about the wonders we see on this world, before our very eyes? The amazing things about the way the human body functions, the amazing things about the rain cycle, how things grow, plant life, how childbirth happens. There are so many incredible things about, you know, when we say the Broch Asher Yotzer, we're talking about the wonders of nature, of how our bodily functions carry on, Baruch Hashem, in any healthy person. That is the way we take it for granted. So he answers, it's because the things we see every day nowadays in our lives, we take them for granted, so we don't realize how amazing they are. And that's why David HaMelech talks about the constellations. But there's one sefer which is an amazing philosophical work, which talks about the beauties of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and so on. Rav Yosef Albo, called the Sefer HaKorim. He lived in the 15th century. He was well known in the year 1413 for leading a disputation against Christians in front of the noblemen and kings of Spain. And in his book, I was interested to find that he really only discusses one aspect of Hashem's nature. As an example, just as an example. And his one aspect which he discusses is the bee and the way it manufactures the honeycomb. Now, just this, here's one example. Because the honeycomb is made up of hexagons. Hexagons are six-sided shapes. Our 50p piece is seven-sided, so I can't hold up a 50 pence piece, but what I could try and hold up is a picture of the honeycomb, and you've got this amazing pattern of these six-sided shapes. And Rav Yosef Albo says, what is it about the bee that's got this intelligence to create such a symmetrical pattern? And why is it that the bee creates this symmetrical pattern? Why can't the bee do these shapes in squares or triangles or circles? Well, the obvious answer about circles is if you put circles next to each other, then you've got gaps between them. And in the gaps, then the bees have to work much harder to create more wax. So they minimize the amount of wax which they have to manufacture. They have to consume 8 ounces of honey for each bit of 1 ounce of wax that they create. So the bees use this for storing their honey. For the pollen, they produce beeswax. And they also want little homes for their young bees. And they create these hexagonal cells, storing the most amount of honey possible, using the least amount of resources. That is the idea behind this. And that Rav Yosef Albo writes that the hexagon achieves this more than any other shape. Now, you might think that squares and triangles can join together closely as well. But he says the hexagon achieves this much more, that the bees have least amount of work for a maximum output. Can you imagine how big the size of the brain is of the bee? How does this bee know? And you've got the upper class and you say, well, anything can happen over billions of years. Rav Yosef writes that the intricate design of the bee and the hexagon on the honeycomb testifies to the Nifloas Habori and the wonders of creation, because the bee could not do this unless a supernatural power enabled the bee to do it, and that is Hashem Yisparach. Those six-sided shapes fit together very perfectly. The hexagon hold the queen bee's eggs, they store the pollen, the honey brought to the hive. So it was noted by a Roman scholar already 2,000 years ago called Marcus Terentius that he noted that the hexagons hold more money and or more honey and less wax. So maybe Rabbi Yosef Albo had the inspiration from this Marcus Tiresias. I don't know. But, you know, bees, there are other amazing things about bees. The fact that they carry pollen from one flower to the next to enable plants to grow, to enable fruit to grow, vegetables, nuts. They all work from the pollen which the bee is helping. And the bees, it was discovered, they use body heat to melt wax for a circle, for this circle shape, for creating the hexagon. Anyway, there's also a professor who, from Washington State University, Pinzon Kwa, who wrote from there that hexagons handle more force, they have more strength for holding the honey. But mathematically, can it be proven that the hexagons are more efficient than the squares or the triangles? And only as recent as 1999 was a professor called Thomas Hales from Michigan University, a professor of mathematics, who proved with a mathematical formula, which I can't understand, you know, with all these funny letters and numbers and square root shapes, he proved mathematically that the hexagon is more economical on the beeswax than the square or the triangle. Even though the square and the triangle close up with each other and there's no distance whatsoever, he proved with a mathematical formula how this Morabuma Secho Hashem. So that is his one example. To understand the wonders of nature, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman writes in his Kovetz Marmorim that there was a midrash which says that an Abikeros came up to Rabbi Akiva and said to him, prove to me that God created the world. So Rabbi Akiva simply said to him, you're wearing a very nice suit. Who made it? He said, the weaver made it. The tailor made it. So Rabbi Akiva answered, well, just as your suit is made by the weaver, so the world is created by Kodesh Baruch Hu. That is the evidence. You see, when you look around, you see intelligence. That suit of yours couldn't have come about by accident. The threads don't just join together and form a suit. There has to be a special intelligence behind it. So that is the way the world is created. Hashem created the world, just like the tailor made your suit. So this is a subject which we could really spend a long time on, because if you look at the Akdamos, which we read on Shavuos, he writes there that if all the world, or if all the seas of the world were made with ink, and all the trees of the world were made into quills or feathers, and all the people of the world would be scribes, there would still not be enough to describe the amazing works of Hashem's creations. And the Rambam writes in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah that when you study the way Hashem created the world, and you study nature, and you study His amazing Neflos HaBorei, that brings you not only to Yiras Shemayim, but also to Avas Hashem. And if I can just give you a quote or two from some leading secular professors on the idea of Neflos HaBorei. Professor Anthony Flew, who lived from 1923 till 2010. He was a professor of philosophy at Reading University, and he described himself for 50 years as an atheist. And when DNA was discovered, the genetic code, he saw a pattern which he said, you cannot refute, it's from a superintelligence. He said, I've changed my mind. To the horror of his atheist followers, he said, there must be a divine intelligence. Professor Sir Fred Hoyle, a leading astronomer at Cambridge University from 1915, he lived till 2001. He started off as an atheist, but in the year 1982, at the age of 67, he said, a common sense interpretation of the facts, showing a super intellect in physics, chemistry, biology, that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates in statistical chances are so overwhelming. Without being deflected by a fear of incurring wrath, one concludes that biomaterials with their amazing measure or order must be the outcome of intelligent design. That a living cell could be arrived at by chance is nonsense of the highest order. So that's not just talking about honeycombs, And that's not just talking about DNA, physics, biology, chemistry. Study the Niflaos HaBorei and you will see the godless of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Tell that to the Abikosim. Thank you very much.